Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
From the Jill Schwartz Memorial Library here in the wilds of Connecticut, this is Obscure Season 2, Frankenstein. I am your friend, your host, your ear lover, your literary mansplainer-in-chief, your soon-to-be Georgianologist, Michael Ian Black. I watched a Frankensteinian movie two nights ago, a sci-fi thingamajiggy-bob called The Titan, starring, I do not know who, but, you know, some actors. And it was okay. It's about a group of Earthlings, really about one Earthling, who is transformed through the power of science to be able to inhabit Saturn's moon of Titan, because the Earth has been so degraded that humanity is looking for a new home. It wasn't great, like I said, but it was Frankensteinian because the whole premise is they're using science to make this man into something of an ubermensch, a superman. And his wife is in on it, and the scientist is in on it, the kid's in on it, everybody's all in on this guy and his friends going to save humanity. And through the power of science. But, you know, there are unforeseen consequences, as these things often go. Unforeseen consequences are always the order of the day when we launch into a new season of Obscure. We are most of the way through our second season, I think. But unforeseen consequences rear their head again. The latest in my life, as you know, is COVID leading to my move to sunny Savannah. I'm dismantling the Jill Schwartz Memorial Library today. One of the things that we have agreed, my dear wife Martha and I, is that we are going to do as little work as possible in terms of packing up the house. The difference in moving costs between the movers packing the house and us packing up the house wasn't as great as I thought it would be, so we're going to have them do it. But even with the minimum amount of work to pack, to, you know, just sort through things, it is a lot of work. So we've been spending the last week or so organizing. Martha is holding a tag sale, a garage sale, this coming weekend. And I was very clear with her from the very beginning that I wanted no part of it. You may think, Michael, why would you not be supportive of making money when all you like to do is scheme to make money? And the answer is deep rooted with me. My mother had, and her partner, had a stationery store when I was a teenager. They had quit their jobs at the Social Security Administration, which they hated, and decided to open their own store. Neither of them had any business experience. Neither of them had much capital to invest, but the store sort of limped along for, let's say, 2 to 3 years, and then it kind of shuttered. When it shuttered, we had a lot of excess inventory, things that went unsold from the store, and my mother and her partner every weekend would hold yard sale. Same thing as a tag sale or garage sale, out of the backyard of our home, modest though the yard was, modest though the home was, and it was tons of bric-a-brac and junk every weekend, all the same junk. And the neighbors complained because we weren't supposed to be holding, basically operating a business out of our backyard. I found the whole thing mortifying, and now I can no longer hold tag sales. I'm incapable of that. I said, I'm not doing that. And as luck would have it, I'm going to be performing this coming weekend in Albany, New York. So I won't be able to be there anyway. But the thought of like haggling with neighbors over, you know, a picture frame or something just fills me with such dread that I can hardly express it. Is my dread existential like that of Victor Frankenstein? No, of course not. My creations, whatever I have assembled in my own house and home, my hearth, are not nearly as abominable as Victor Frankenstein's, though some of them, as I go through my things, are indeed abominable. I'm thinking in particular of my high school journals. But they don't threaten to kill me the way Big Buddy has threatened to kill everything and everyone that Victor Frankenstein holds dear. His father has appeared to him to help him recover his health after Victor was accused of the murder of poor Henry Clerval. And the appearance of his father has indeed helped him along. And so we pick up the story here, Volume 3, Chapter 4 of Frankenstein. He says, I gradually recovered my health. Now, this is after the father came. And now I continue. As my sickness quitted me, I was absorbed by a gloomy and black melancholy that nothing could dissipate. Come on, man. The whole book has been you in a gloomy and black melancholy. That's your whole thing. That's your vibe. You're the guy that's in a gloomy and black melancholy, as is probably most of humanity. Most of the time, right? Probably 80% of the listeners to this podcast find themselves in a gloomy and black melancholy, at least some of the time, right? I mean, it's no big deal, and it's not surprising to hear it from you, and it's not a particularly interesting character development. You have always been that way. You are an emo kid. We've talked about this before. I understand that this is the first sci-fi book. It's also the first emo book. The image of Clerval was forever before me, ghastly and murdered. More than once, the agitation into which these reflections threw me made my friends dread a dangerous relapse. Alas, why did they preserve so miserable and detested a life? It was surely that I might fill my destiny, which is now drawing to a close. Soon, oh, very soon will death extinguish these throbbings and relieve me from the mighty weight of anguish that bears me to the dust. And in executing the award of justice, I shall also sink to rest. Then the appearance of death was distant, although the wish was ever present to my thoughts, and I often sat for hours motionless and speechless, wishing for some mighty revolution that might bury me and my destroyer in its ruins. I was watching a clip of Tom Hiddleston. That's his name, right? The guy who plays Loki. And I've seen this premise before on talk shows where somebody who sounds nice, you know, they've got a nice voice, they'll just have them read something kind of banal to prove that they have a great voice and that they're entertaining just by virtue of their vocal prowess. And so they had Tom Hiddleston reading mathematical equations, Einstein's general theory of relativity, and the Pythagorean theory.
E equals mc squared. The Pythagorean equation is a squared plus b squared equals c squared.
He indeed did sound lovely reading them. But it doesn't seem, it hardly seems fair, does it? That, you know, the guy's good looking, the guy's talented, he also has a lovely voice. Like, you know, pick one of three. You get one of three or something. At least have him be like a Rudolph Valentino, you know, like a screechy crow voice. Rudolph Valentino, that's his name, right? Biggest movie star in the world, silent film era. And then, you know, talkies came and he couldn't speak worth a damn. I'm self-conscious now because I'm thinking about my own voice, reading the Pythagorean theorem on Jimmy Kimmel or whatever the hell it is, and understanding, realizing that it would not be particularly entertaining to anybody. A squared plus B squared equals C squared. That's not entertaining. God damn it. Why? Does anybody else just sit in your home and ponder why you're not better at things? It's all I do. Why am I not better at things? Seems I should be better at some things. If anything, my aptitude in all things seems to be dissipating. I don't know. The season of the assizes approached. A-S-S-I-Z-E-S. Assizes, assizes, and there's no footnote or anything, so I got to look up. I got to crank up the old research machine. Let me just see. We put water in it this weekend so it doesn't overheat. I think we did. And so I will look up assizes. Assizes. So funny. Judicial inquest. An action to be decided by such an inquest. So a trial, I guess. It's a trial session held periodically in specific locations in England, usually by a judge of a superior court. So I guess maybe they didn't have enough judges or something, and so they would travel around, and then there'd be a season of them, you know, because you couldn't do it all year round. So, you know, it's coming. The trial's coming. I'd already been 3 months in prison, and although I was still weak and in continual danger of a relapse, I was obliged to travel nearly 100 miles to the county town where the court was held. Mr. Kerwin charged himself with every care of collecting witnesses and arranging my defense. I was spared the disgrace of appearing publicly as a criminal, as the case was not brought before the court that decides on life and death. Well, why wouldn't it? Why wouldn't it be a life and death case? Let's see. The grand jury rejected the bill on its being proved that I was on the Orkney Islands at the hour the body of my friend was found, and a fortnight after my removal, I was liberated from prison. That's it? That's the whole thing? Why did we just spend pages and pages and pages on this bullshit? This is what's annoying about this book. It's all ramp up. It's all ramp up to the thingamajig. And then anticlimax. He's about to be on trial for his life for murder. And then she's like, well, we figured it out. He wasn't there at the time. So they let him go. I mean, Mary, that's not good storytelling, Mary. Get out your red pencil. And edit a little. Lazy Mary. Lazy writing is what it is. So a fortnight after my removal, I was liberated from prison. Okay, great, fine. I don't know why we wasted all this time then. My father was enraptured on finding me freed from the vexations of a criminal charge, that I was again allowed to breathe the fresh atmosphere and permitted to return to my native country. I did not participate in these feelings, for to me, the walls of a dungeon or a palace were alike hateful. Yeah, emo kid. The cup of life was poisoned forever. And although the sun shone upon me, as upon the happy and gay of heart, I saw around me nothing but a dense and frightful darkness, penetrated by no light but the glimmer of two eyes that glared upon me. Yeah. Big Buddy's eyes. I mean, look, I know I do a lot of important literary analysis on this podcast, but I wanted to emphasize to all of you that the two eyes that glared upon him in his imagination were in fact Big Buddy's eyes. Yeah, if that wasn't clear, I'm peeling back the text. You know, I'm doing textual analysis here, and it's very, very impressive. Sometimes they were the expressive eyes of Henry. Oh, so I was wrong. I mean, after making my dumb joke, I was immediately slapped in the face by Mary Shelley, who's clearly still mad at me for telling her that it was bad writing, because they're not always the Big Buddy. Sometimes they're Henry. Sometimes they were the expressive eyes of Henry, languishing in death, the dark orbs nearly covered by the lids and the long black lashes that fringed them. Sometimes it was the watery, clouded eyes of the monster, as I first saw them in my chamber at Ingolstadt. I'm feeling a little parched. I'm going to take a moment. It's gloomy here in the Jill Schwartz Memorial Library, and I wonder if that's affecting my alertness and the tone of this episode, if I'm a little bit subdued, if I am a little bit black and melancholy in my presentation. Let us blame the weather, shall we not? And I will try to pick up my act when we return on Obscure.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait till you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
I'm back. I'm cleansed. I'm parched. Still tired, you know, still a little tired. Even lo these 30 seconds that have passed, I am still a bit tired. So, you know, let's keep going. We'll see. My father tried to awaken in me the feelings of affection. So, you know, his father's trying to slap him around and say, wake up, boy, wake up. You know, you got good things in your life. I'm trying to slap myself around and say, wake up, you got a podcast to finish. He talked of Geneva, which I should soon visit, of Elizabeth and Ernest, but these words only drew deep groans from me. Sometimes, indeed, I felt a wish for happiness and thought with melancholy delight of my beloved cousins or longed with a devouring maladie du pays, which I think, I'm not even going to look it up, but I think that's homesickness, to see once more the blue lake and rapid Rhone that had been so dear to me in early childhood. But my general state of feeling was a torpor, we know, in which a prison was as welcome a residence as the divinest scene in nature, we know, and these fits were seldom interrupted but by paroxysms of anguish and despair. We know, Victor. We're just in a rut here of you feeling sorry for yourself. It does not make a good read. People feeling sorry for themselves, people playing the victim, does not make for a good read. It just doesn't. It doesn't make for a good life either. But I don't want to, but nor do I want to read about it. I mean, at least put some jokes in, for God's sake. At these moments, I often endeavored to put an end to the existence I loathed. Then do it. Fucking find a rope and fucking find a tree, dude. I mean, enough. And it required unceasing attendance and vigilance to restrain me from committing some dreadful act of violence. Okay, fine. Yet one duty remained to me. Okay, then this is what we need. You know, we need your sense of obligation here. We need the hero's journey to continue. We need you to be propelled forward. I've said it before. This is why I don't like Hamlet. Same shit. The recollection of which finally triumphed over my selfish despair. It was necessary that I should return without delay to Geneva, there to watch over the lives of those I so fondly loved, and to lie in wait for the murderer, that if any chance led me to the place of his concealment, or if he dared again to blast me by his presence, I might, with unfailing aim, put an end to the existence of the monstrous image which I had endured with the mockery of a soul still more monstrous. Okay, I gotta go back because I'm not sure I fully understand that. I might, with unfailing aim, put an end to the existence of the monstrous image, right, which I had endued. That's where I screwed up. I said endured. I had endued with the mockery of a soul still more monstrous. So he's saying, yeah, I made an ugly thing, but the soul is even uglier than the thing. The dude's ugly, but you got to look at his soul, bro. Bro, his soul, really ugly, bro. You got to check that shit out. My father still desired to delay our departure, fearful that I could not sustain the fatigues of a journey, for I was a shattered wreck, the shadow of a human being. My strength was gone. I was a mere skeleton, and fever, night and day, preyed upon my wasted frame. Still, as I urged our leaving Ireland, with such inquietude and impatience, my father thought it best to yield. We took our passage on board a vessel bound for Havre de Grace, and sailed with a fair wind from the Irish shores. It was midnight. I lay on the deck looking at the stars and listening to the dashing of the waves. I hailed the darkness that shut Ireland from my sight, and my pulse beat with a feverish joy when I reflected that I should soon see Geneva. The past appeared to me in the light of a frightful dream, yet the vessel in which I was, the wind that blew me from the detested shore of Ireland, and the sea which surrounded me, told me too forcibly that I was deceived by no vision, and that Clerval, my friend and dearest companion, had fallen a victim to me and the monster of my creation. I repassed in my memory my whole life, my quiet happiness while residing with my family in Geneva, the death of my mother, and my departure for Ingolstadt. I remembered, shuddering, the mad enthusiasm that hurried me on to the creation of my hideous enemy, and I called to mind the night in which he first lived. I was unable to pursue the train of thought. A thousand feelings pressed upon me, and I wept bitterly. I don't know if you guys know anything about the near-death experience. You know, in addition to the UFOs that I have been, paying some time attention to. I think I've talked about how I also have been paying attention to near-death experiences. And the overlap between the two is striking. And the overlap between the two of those two things, and at the very least this moment of Victor Frankenstein's life, also striking as he's conducting a life review, a common feature of the near-death experience. He finds himself in an otherworldly place, lying on his back in the sea, surrounded by an impenetrable darkness, and images of his life to that point flash before him. And one of the interesting components of the near-death experience, that's something I didn't know till I was doing a little more research into it, is that in the life review, which is that moment when your life flashes before your eyes and you see everything you have ever done, one of the startling claims made by people who have done this, gone through this, is that you simultaneously see the events of your life through your own eyes, right? But then, or concurrent with that, you also see and experience those same events through the eyes of the person or people with whom you were interacting. And so you feel what they felt in your moments with them. And that is, that sounds horrible. When I think about all the horrible things that I've said and done over the years, all the interactions I've had with people who probably thought to themselves, hey, that guy's a jerk, or that guy hurt me, or whatever. It's much easier to remember the times when one has caused pain, or at least, if not the specific instances, at least that familiar kind of creeping dread that one has, and when I say one, I mean me, of all the people you may have offended in your life in one manner or another. And it seems like that must be the most painful part of death. The death experience is having to go through a life review. My God. I mean, just the sheer number of times I've masturbated, and I'd have to look at that? Come on! Doesn't seem fair, does it? It doesn't seem fair, Mary. On the other hand, they say, those experiencers, that the beings, people, guides, whatever you want to call them, who go through this with you or sort of are guiding you through this, are very nice about it. You know, they're very empathetic. They're not being judgy about it. They're like, yeah, Michael, you really jerked off a lot in this lifetime. But they're not being like, you shouldn't have done that. They're observing. You know, it's dispassionate. And then I guess my soul would be like, yeah, I really did. Huh. What do you think about that? And I'm not saying, look, I this got onto a tangent that I didn't want to get onto. I don't think I masturbate any more than anybody else. I just want to clarify that. But yeah, Victor Frankenstein going through his own little life review right there. And I imagine, you know, it's got to be incredibly painful for him. So painful that he cannot continue the train of thought. He's unable to pursue it. He weeps bitterly. Bitter, bitter tears. Ever since my recovery from the fever, I had been in the custom of taking every night a small quantity of laudanum. Oh, where do you get that? And can I have some? It's nice. There's something really nice about the 19th, 18th, 17th centuries, wherever, where, you know, they have opiates and they're like, yeah, just take opiates. It's fine. You know, you got whole opium dens back then. Just people kind of lounging out, smoking dope, chilled, people coming around, bringing them tea and stuff. Sounds great. It sounds great. It, you know, I could absolutely see myself spending, I don't know, a month in an opium den. Maybe not a month, maybe 2 weeks, you know, as a kind of getaway, just smoking dope and drinking tea. It sounds okay to me. So he's taken dope, for it was by means of this drug only that I was enabled to gain the rest necessary for the preservation of life. Nobody ever talks about how good opiates are for you. Nobody ever says, you know what, opium, yeah, it's got its problem, but it's also pretty good for you. I don't know why they don't say that. Oppressed by the recollection of my various misfortunes, I now swallowed double my usual quantity and soon slept profoundly. But sleep did not afford me respite from thought and misery. My dreams presented 1,000 objects that scared me. Towards morning, I was possessed by a kind of nightmare. I felt the fiend's grasp in my neck and could not free myself from it. Groans and cries rang in my ears. My father, who was watching over me, perceiving my restlessness, awoke me. The dashing waves were around, the cloudy sky above. The fiend was not here. A sense of security, a feeling that a truce was established between the present hour and the irresistible, disastrous future, imparted to me a kind of calm forgetfulness of which the human mind is by its structure peculiarly susceptible. End of chapter 4. Well, I don't know if it's the human mind that is peculiarly susceptible to that, or it's just the dope talking. But I will say this, getting back to the Titan for a moment. One of the premise of the Titan is that, and as I said, Earth has become so degraded that people, you know, there's like a line in the beginning of the movie where it's basically just like a narrator or voiceover or something saying, you know, basically in 10 or 15 years, half of humanity will have starved to death, right? Certain cities are becoming inhabitable because of the environmental disaster we have wrought. And this is common knowledge in the world of the film. Everybody's going to die, right? But the beginning of the film is all about this family, the guy who's going to go to Titan and his wife and his kid, and they're showing up on this military base where he's going to undergo training and do the scientific experiments and everything. And they're all kind of acting like everything's fine, you know? Like, they understand, like, the Earth is going to be uninhabitable in a couple decades, but for the moment, the kid's still going to school, you know? They're having play dates. They're getting together and drinking wine at night with the other astronauts. And it struck me that that actually is probably the way it would go. I mean, it's the way it is going, right? I mean, we don't have an end date. We don't know. It's going to be 15 years before the Earth becomes uninhabitable. It's probably more like 150 or something, if nothing changes. But we just sort of bumble through our lives, right? We just sort of put on blinders. We ourselves, those of us not in the Titan, have a kind of calm forgetfulness about us, of which the human mind is, by its structure, peculiarly susceptible. My own mind is. You know, like, we have anxiety. Like, that is true. You know, when we talk about the gloom and black melancholy that we all experience, like, we have depression, we have anxiety about the future, but I feel like for most people, there's a kind of parallel emotional track that runs with that anxiety, which is a sort of nearsightedness. I always get nearsightedness and farsightedness mixed up. But the one where you only see near, you can't see far, I feel like we all kind of have that, a kind of myopia, where we can't plan too far in the future. We can't think too far in the future. We can't project ourselves into likely outcomes or scenarios. Most of us, I can't. And so we sort of, you know, we have blinders on most of the time. Or, you know, it's like when you're walking through the woods, as I was earlier today, and rather than looking out at the vista, the variety of biology assembled before you, you just sort of look down at your feet so you don't trip. But that's not the best way to enjoy a walk in the woods. We all know that. But too many of us, all of us, most of us, take your pick of which quantity of us, spend most of our lives looking down at our feet. And in a way, it's good. You know, in a way, that is probably a pretty good survival mechanism. Because if we were to see the fullness of the future in front of us and its variety, meaning like the options arrayed before us, perhaps life itself would become intolerable. We would be stuck at every fork of the road. We wouldn't know which way to go because we would see all of the choices arrayed before us. Rather than just, oh, I think I'll go here. I'm looking down at the ground and there's no stone here, so I'll just step there. You know what I mean? I don't know if I'm making any sense. As I said, it's a gloomy day here in the Jill Schwartz Memorial Library, and I am a bit sleepy. Gloomy, not particularly. Melancholic, not really, no. But a little bit sleepy. It is my nap time. I have exhausted myself packing up 3 or 4 boxes as I get ready to depart, as I get ready to put one step on my own rocky path. And so we'll leave it there. We will pick it up next week on another meandering episode of Obscure. But until then, I wish you adieu. Obscure Season 2 Frankenstein is produced by Robin Lynn, Mary Shimkin, Jennifer Brennan, and myself. It is generally recorded in the wilds of Connecticut with original theme music by Craig Wedren. If you would like to support this podcast, please go to patreon.com/MichaelIanBlack, where not only will you be receiving every single episode of Obscure Season 2 Frankenstein way before the general public hears them, but you'll also get bonus episodes, writings, musings, jokes aplenty, and if you sign up to our highest tier, you get to join the semi-regular book club, which we hold every now and again. It's patreon.com/MichaelIanBlack.